Welcome to the newly refurbished lecture theatre in the Arts Tower. My name's Jo, I'm from the Palestine Society with PSE, and we're really happy to have three of you here. We're all having done it, inundated each other with lots of leaflets, but there's a couple of things I want to say briefly because we all need to leave before the end. There's leaflets at the end if you want to take them. We're having another event tomorrow at the university. We've got an Israeli anarchist coming to talk about Israelis who are against occupation. We're having a day of action on Friday from noon to commemorate the Nakba, and PSC have got a fundraising dinner in June. Also, Abdul Lieberman is coming to London tomorrow. If you'd like to go to London to protest, please do that. If you can't, David Miliband's email address is written on the front. So if you'd like to send him a very angry email, that would be great. But without further ado, let's hear from Fiva, because that's why we're all here.
Hello and salamu alaikum. I'm going to try to speak without a microphone, but I've got sort of a soft voice, so if it's needed, tell me and I'll use it. But obviously, thank you to you all for organizing tonight. What I was planning on doing is perhaps just speaking for a few minutes, giving a general overview of the situation on the ground in Gaza at the moment, a little bit perhaps about the war, and then to open up the floor for questions and comments, because I think that more accurately will dictate the course of the discussion, perhaps over the next hour. I've met a variety of different groups here already today in Sheffield, and I know that as a community, that people who are active in Palestine solidarity activities are very active and obviously very informed. So I don't want to be stating the obvious to you. I know you also have Mushir and his family in your midst, which is such an important resource in the sense of, I think, bringing that information back and really personalizing and humanizing narratives on the ground in the Gaza, which oftentimes are lost, even for those of us who support this struggle. I think the horrific nature of the sort of statistics that were coming out during the war and in the course of the siege and occupation are oftentimes overwhelming. I have been speaking, along with another colleague, Eva Yusevich, over the last few days about Free Gaza as a movement, about the situation on the ground in Gaza, and about practical things that we can be doing as a solidarity community to ensure that the outrage and solidarity that was certainly present during the war is accurately translated or channeled into sustained strategic long-term campaigns and links with the people of Gaza, who are under continual siege. In the context of Gaza, I think it's very important for us all to remember, although it has dropped off the news radar, that the war in Gaza did not begin and did not end with the massacres in December and January, that the massacres were an intensification of a policy of massacre, of collective punishment, of siege, and of, in many ways of a very slow drip genocide. The situation on the ground, obviously, in Gaza during the war, as we all witnessed, was horrific. The deliberate, systematic, and intentional targeting of civilians and of civilian and humanitarian infrastructure was something that I think even the spin machine of the Israeli army and government could not hide from a lot of people who perhaps the intensity of the bombings provided a pathway into politicization and awareness of the situation in Gaza. But certainly, you know, it's oftentimes very hard to articulate, even to those of us, I think, who have been active in the West Bank and in other contexts, the nature of the massacres that were carried out in December and January. They were sustained, they were completely indiscriminate, and there was really no safe place in Gaza. It was made clear, I think, to people from all walks of life, from all professions, from all backgrounds, from all places of inhabitants in Gaza, that their blood had been further cheapened to the point of expendability, that our governments in the West had given this green light and was prepared to watch the massacre of men, women, and children, you know, and that there was nothing to keep people physically safe on the ground. And sometimes I think, you know, it's easy for people in Gaza and in Palestine in general to feel very, very isolated, to feel collectively abandoned, to believe, you know, that many people in the West and the rest of the world have forgotten them. And that is because they don't see a direct translation of the demonstrations and solidarity activities into any mechanism that keeps them safe, into any mechanism that coordinates an ambulance into the areas in which their children are bleeding to death, as happened in many cases during the massacres. One specific case, which I'm sure you're all aware of, was the Samouni family. And the fact that they were calling radio stations, calling the media, calling ambulance services to come and take away their dead and wounded and to evacuate them. And it wasn't until there were two coordinated evacuations of members of the Samouni family and other families in Al Zaytoun that paramedics and emergency workers were actually allowed in. And when they were allowed in and were greeted, you know, just with scenes of dead and decaying bodies, Of the wounded, of families who were dehydrated because they had been kept imprisoned in their homes for days. These paramedics were not allowed to bring in ambulances. They had to walk in on foot, and then they were told by Israeli snipers that they were allowed to evacuate the dead or wounded only on a donkey cart, but they weren't allowed to use the donkey. So paramedics ended up pulling donkey carts of dead and wounded men, women, and children out on foot for 2 kilometers back to their ambulances. And this is one example of not only the collective punishment and massacre of Palestinian civilians, but also on direct and systematic attacks on Palestinian medical workers. During the war, there were 16 medical workers killed. 13 of those were paramedics, 3 were ambulance volunteers. There were over 39 Palestinian medical workers wounded, over 27 medical institutions targeted, and it set a very dangerous precedent. Certainly, we found while we were working as volunteers on Palestinian medical relief services and Red Crescent and Ministry of Health ambulances that every time those paramedics stepped foot in their ambulances, there was a very real possibility of them being killed. And they are the unsung, the unspoken heroes, I think, of this struggle. They and Palestinian journalists put their lives on the line every time they go out in their ambulances, and yet they continue to do so because this is a form of resistance. This is a form of keeping their communities intact, of those precious minutes between life and death, you know, of taking that risk to try and save people. And it is a community, because they are under siege, that we really need. And this is one of our hopes in our talks in different countries in Europe, but to build a campaign of solidarity with Palestinian medical and emergency workers, you know, and to really try and translate some of the horror and outrage that people feel into mechanisms that break the isolation, that focus people perhaps outside of the communities, the activist communities that we work in, into something that can access people from all different walks of life, that can give people practical things to do. The situation following the cessation of the bombing, you know, oftentimes when you speak to people in Gaza, they say for many people the war has not ended. The siege has intensified since the war. There's actually less relief getting in post-war or post-massacres than there were before the bombing began. The impossibility of any reconstruction is compounded by the fact that the Israeli occupation blocks any building materials from coming in. So no cement is coming in, no steel, no wood, no paint, etc. There was a housing crisis before the bombing began, and this has been obviously exacerbated by the thousands of families that are now homeless. Many of them are living with host families, with extended families, with their friends, but there's a limit to the amount of space in which people can actually physically fit, and many thousands of these families are now living between a variety of camps of the displaced that are located in different parts of the Gaza Strip. We've been working with a variety of these camps, principally in the north, and the living conditions are very desperate. There is very little relief coming in. As mentioned, a lot of the camps do not have electricity. Some of these camps, one of them, near Atatra, which houses over 300 families, has two toilets and two showers. They were freezing during the winter, and now with the beginning of the summer, the conditions inside the tents are really, you know, like a sauna. They're like an oven. And you see again, you know, the desperation of people in the sense of it's not hysterical, but the desperation of mothers and fathers who cannot physically provide for their children. That was something that was heartbreaking during the war. Mothers and fathers' deep realization that they could not keep their children physically safe, that nothing that they could do could keep their children physically safe, but that has continued post-massacres in the sense that families cannot physically provide for their children. And they're so vulnerable. It's so clear. They're a very strong, very noble, very proud, very steadfast community, but they're very vulnerable. And it's very clear, you know, that the next attack or the next war or the next massacre could take place quite soon. And this is something that people have to live with and continue to live with, in the sense, you know, feeling that vulnerability and feeling that natural fear, and yet continuing to educate their children, continuing to build, continuing to marry, continuing to generation after generation, you know, keep just this steadfastness, which really, when you live in Gaza, and I've spent time in the West Bank and in refugee camps of Palestinians in Iraq and Lebanon, etc. But the conditions in Gaza are extreme. I know certainly the two of us, myself and my colleague, after having spent about 6 months in Gaza, coming out, we felt like liberated prisoners. And we felt this guilt in the sense, you know, that obviously we had a lot of, I think we were torn in terms of the decision to leave, even to come out and do talks for a month before coming back, in the sense that you do feel like you're abandoning people. You do feel like, you know, the privilege and the racism of the fact that we can cross that border and they can't, when their family members are dying of diseases, when they're trapped students, you know, when they're separated or displaced families, etc. But when we came out, you know, just the expanse of space driving through the Sinai, the expanse of space here, you know, getting on a bus or a train and traveling for hours, the control that you can have over your decisions, which in Gaza you really can't. There's very little that people have control over in terms of any decision-making process. But again, you know, it's this crazy contradiction in Gaza of extreme suffering, extreme oppression, extreme loss and grief, and it's saturated. The land is literally saturated with the blood and sacrifice of generation after generation of people who have been murdered. But it's contrasted also with the beauty, you know, and that's something I think that anybody who comes to Gaza is always shocked by. We were at a talk last night in Manchester with folks from the Viva Palestina convoy, and they were showing pictures that were beautiful, you know, of the ocean, of the coast, of families, of faces. And it was, you could see people in the audience were surprised, because it's not something that we see. We see, you know, Gaza in its moments of massacre, of suffering, of loss. But we don't see, you know, that resilience, that spirit, that beauty, which keeps generation after generation going. And I think which gives energy and strength and resolve to anybody who, from the outside, who goes there to work on the ground. And it's certainly something that I'd encourage anybody here, you know, to do if possible. There are practical things that one can work or volunteer with in Gaza. And it does, you know, even in a very small symbolic way, but it breaks that sense of isolation for people to sit, to listen, to absorb some of that pain and grief and anger and frustration. And also, you know, to celebrate the joyousness in many ways of that decision, you know, of people who refuse to give in to despair, despite the fact that I think any other society of people living under similar conditions would break, because it is designed, it is systematic. I think the siege, the way that it's created, the way that it's enacted, and it is designed to break people, which it hasn't. And I think it's that strength, that steadfastness, that resilience, which has to be a challenge to us, you know, to match in word and in deed, that level of sacrifice, that level of risk in many ways. What I was thinking of doing, you know, is perhaps talking a little bit about a few different issues, three, and then opening up the floor to questions. But one thing that I was just thinking about when I was speaking earlier to a group of activists from Sheffield is the fact that, that the steady land grab, which has gone on since the massacres, is not well known or not something that, that's spoken about with too much regularity. We've been working along with activists from the international solidarity movements on accompanying farmers and fishermen. They are two targeted communities. They're under continual fire, continual siege. And since the cessation of the aerial bombardment, with the exception of so-called targeted assassinations in which many people are always killed, there has been a steady targeting of Palestinian farmers, of Gazan farmers. The Israeli occupation forces have an undeclared policy of enforcing a buffer zone, a so-called buffer zone. And this is basically from the border, sometimes 300, sometimes 500 meters in, and sometimes up to a kilometer in. And it means that any farmer or farming community trying to engage in subsistence farming, as they plant very unprofitable crops, but crops that are low-lying. So, and the logic behind this is both, you know, that they produce regularly, that they can keep the earth cultivated, but also that they're low-lying so that you're actually less risk as you're harvesting. So people are now focusing mainly on lentils, on parsley, which sell, a bunch of parsley sells for a shekel, which is maybe the equivalent of 20 or 30p. And literally every day that these farmers go out, they are risking their lives. There have been two Palestinian farmers that have been killed, shot through the head and neck since January. There have been a number of wounded. One of them was actually part of a team that we were working with, a young man who was deaf, who was shot in the leg. It was seen as a warning to the family who continued to cultivate their land. But many farmers speak about this as a form of resistance, that in resisting the land grab, in resisting the severing of this land, which has been passed from generation to generation, that they are resisting this occupation and land grab. And it is something, I think, that both their situation and that of Palestinian fishermen in some ways is almost an easy sell. And I know this sounds awfully mercenary, but to, I think, communities in Europe that perhaps are, you know, still ignorant or misinformed by the media. But to talk about attacks on farmers and fishermen, to try and build links between agricultural and fisher people unions, etc., could be something, another practical thing, if people have time and inclination and context to do so. The situation, as I mentioned, of Palestinian paramedics is very desperate. They during the course of the massacres, 23 Palestinian ambulances were damaged. Some of those have been replaced by donations, but Palestinian paramedics are still in a state where if there is another attack, because the medical infrastructure of Gaza was already operating at crisis point before the massacres began, but that they'll be incredibly at risk again. They do not have flak jackets. They do not have bright torches. During the war, we were working with paramedics who were working literally with pen lights or small flashlights to try and locate bodies after there had been airstrikes. Oftentimes there would be no electricity, and even shining a little light, even when people are, or paramedics are wearing fluorescent vests and in clearly marked ambulances, etc., is potentially suicidal, because Israeli drones were targeting anything that moved, including ambulances. But these paramedics are facing into the possibility of more attacks and more strikes, with a further debilitated infrastructure. They're facing into more attacks and strikes with, you know, the very clear awareness that they are now seen as permissible targets. There has been no legal process or follow-up to the targeting of Palestinian paramedics or the 18 emergency workers from the civil defense that were also killed. And this means, you know, that I think in most people looking at the situation would think that the number of people engaging in paramedic courses, etc., would go down. But it's actually shot through the roof dramatically, the amount of young Palestinian men and women who are signing up for paramedic and ambulance driver courses, because this is seen as a form of resistance. And people lived through the 23 days of the massacres with the disempowerment and impotency of seeing their family members and community and friends bleeding to death. And a lot of the people who have enrolled in these courses actually had family members who were killed during the massacres. So again, any support that can be given to this community, which is under siege is vital. The third group of people, which again I think is something that sort of falls off the map when we're confronted with the, you know, the just the very dramatic nature of the strikes, etc., and the horrific nature, are Palestinian prisoners. There are over 11,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons. Over 300 of those are children, over 100 of those are women. And Gazan families who have prisoners in Israeli prisons are not being allowed any access to visit them. Most of them have not had any access whatsoever to prison visits, at least since the onset of the Second Intifada, some of them for many more years than that. We're working with a group primarily of mothers of prisoners, some of them who have not seen their loved ones for over 12 years. They're known as the living martyrs of the struggle, and they are. They are subjected to systematic physical and psychological torture, isolation, denial of any privileges, denial of their right to communicate with their families, and their situation is getting progressively worse. The Israeli government has, and judicial system has, further adopted a set of emergency laws, which so-called emergency laws, which are actually left over from the British mandate, but which pertain specifically to Gazan prisoners, which designates them as enemy combatants. And that means they have no rights whatsoever. They have military trials. A lot of them are not given access to any legal representation whatsoever. And they are, as mentioned, really the living martyrs of this struggle. They sacrifice so much. Many of them have never seen their children. Many of them have had family members or parents who have died since they've been in prison, and they've not been allowed, you know, even to attend a burial service. So it is, again, another forgotten community that if anybody can get involved in, we're trying to build links between prisoner organization groups from all of the factions on the ground in Gaza with solidarity groups outside. And it is one issue, you know, despite the fact of the political schism that is so heartbreaking in many ways in Gaza, it is one of the few issues that actually unites factions, or unites at least people who have political affiliations to different factions on the ground. And unfortunately, not enough. Recently, there was an International Prison Day, and all of the factions planned different calendars and different activities, etc. But there has been the beginning of some process, hopefully, of there being a more united stance in terms of the prisoners. You know, and I think also the need within this discourse to talk about political prisoners, both in Ramallah and Gaza as well, you know, and to really challenge, you know, just what is, I think, a very cheap, you know, political move by both. By both Hamas and Fatah, in the sense, you know, of the need for unity is so strong. But I think this is something that even if on a leadership level, it's still far away, that certainly on a popular level, despite the fact that there was some division during the war, we certainly found that amongst people who were engaged in practical work, that factional divides and divisions literally went out the window, and there was a very acute sense of the need, you know, just for mutual cooperation and practical work during the war. The paramedic issue is another issue, I think, that brings people from various different political backgrounds together. And we've started to work on the concept of a union that could officially twin with unions of paramedics in Europe. Last thing, schools and universities, again, another practical thing that could be worked on. I met with a school earlier on today, Springfield School, which was incredible, and really, hats off. I'm so sorry I've forgotten your name because my brain is like a sieve at the moment. But to the sister in the room. It's inspirational, and if any of you have a chance, really, I'm not sure in what context, but to visit it, it was so beautiful. And really, you know, I just felt, you know, listening to these poised, composed, confident, politicized little kids, you know, just talk with such beauty and dedication, I think, about the children of Gaza, just really reminded me, you know, how untainted they are, and how I think that inherent sense of justice that children have, you know, which is just so automatic and so, you know, unspoken, is so important, you know, to foster the confidence of that conviction that this is wrong, you know, and I think the practical suggestions that they were coming out with were well beyond their years. But hopefully, you know, we're thinking about the possibility of twinnings between schools in Gaza and universities and hospitals, etc., but specifically schools and schools in Europe and hopefully down the road in Latin and South America and Africa and Asia, and to widen it out. Firstly, because this breaks a sense of isolation for Gazan students, of which there were 167 killed during the war. And also acts as an awareness-raising and educative tool for not only the students in these schools here, but also their families, their communities, their teachers. It just broadens the scope and the outreach of solidarity activities. And I think people in Gaza really need to hear that, and this is something I think that both myself and fellow activists and other colleagues in Gaza sort of feel, that some of our role there, you know, is practical volunteering or practical work. And some of our role is just to listen, just to listen, you know, and to try and represent an alternative face of the West, you know, to try and represent a voice or a face or a friend, you know, as a sister of compassion and understanding and outrage, and impress upon people, you know, it's that we do not see them as victims, that we see them as survivors, that they are strong, that they are noble, that they are unbroken, and they are the victim of Israeli war crimes and the victims of collective punishment. But their steadfastness and their courage is a challenge to us all, and we learn from them. I really feel so acutely and so intensely in Gaza, you know, that they are really my teachers, our teachers, collectively. And when you see this intergenerational strength and resistance and dedication to producing generation after generation who hold on to the dream of rights, to the dream of living with freedom and dignity and stability, of being able to decide, you know, and to be able to predict what today and tomorrow and next week will bring you and your family, that this process of witnessing this is something, I think, that humbles us all. And it's a process, I think, when you live amongst a community of people who are unbroken, who refuse to be broken, that really makes one, I think, engage in a process of learning to control one's fear instead of allowing fear to control oneself. And that's certainly a process that we went through on the ambulances. I think, you know, perhaps the first few days for all of the international volunteers who worked on the ambulances were frightening. But when you're working alongside men and women who are so brave, who are so dedicated, watching the tenderness, and that's something that always strikes me about Palestinian paramedics. They have seen so much. They have lived from massacre to massacre. They bear the scars of those massacres and assaults on their bodies. We know of one Palestinian paramedic, a friend of ours called Ashraf, who has been shot on 6 different occasions while evacuating the wounded. But watching them, despite the fact that they've seen so much, and I think most people seeing the extent of the loss and the blood and the massacre that they see would be thoroughly desensitized, but seeing the tenderness with which they carry those bodies, the tenderness with which they dig out the parts of other people's children, the tenderness with which they carry these broken bodies, and the tenderness with which they interact with the grieving families is something which is quite beautiful. And again, I think testament to the fact that despite the fact that this occupation and siege is designed to dehumanize, to break, you know, the fact that they hold on to that humanity, to that love, to that compassion, is something quite tremendous. What I was thinking of now is perhaps opening up the floor to questions. And then I have a little bit of footage. I think you saw some of it. It was families being evacuated from Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia during the White Phosphorus attacks. And then there's other footage of the aftermath of a few massacres, which I really, what I wanted to do was to bring some footage, you know, that gave insight, because I think whatever we watch on YouTube or through alternative media, etc., it's always little sound bites, and it's difficult just to get a sense of the atmosphere surrounding, you know, these horrible massacres and losses for people. But what I wanted to do was actually to bring out footage also of the beauty of Gaza, to be able to show you both the loss and also the steadfastness, the beauty, the richness of the place, because it is so rich. And it literally, when you step into Gaza, and I felt this myself during the war, because I was away for the first part of the war, because we had brought some students out to Cyprus on a boat, and then I tried to come back in on a free Gaza boat, and we were around, and we went to Lebanon, and then I waited at Rafah for 5 days before I got coordination to go in with a group of Egyptian and Norwegian doctors, but literally crossing just after those days of waiting and after watching, you know, just the bombing from afar and seeing the broken, wounded bodies of men, women, and children being evacuated across Rafah. The minute that bus passed through, the minute that it passed through the gates, I just literally felt, you know, that it is such a blessing, it is such an honor to be able to stand with these people, because they are inspirational. And I know sometimes it's easy for us to sort of, you know, fluctuate, you know, in these very polarized terms between victim and hero. And not everybody is heroic, and not everybody wants to be heroic. There are many people who want, you know, an ordinary life. But they are. They really are an inspiration. And they humble us, I think, through their lives, through their teaching. So, on that note, perhaps if I could open up the floor to questions or comments or announcements.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on from the heart talk, because I mean, one of the things I don't like about people who go to Palestine and back, they speak to us as reporters, and certainly you spoke from your heart and you moved me personally and you reminded me of Gaza and the people there, so thanks for that. The second thing is, it's important what you mentioned about support for the Palestinians, not as victims but as survivors, as people who are fighting for their rights. Mm-hmm. It's important. It's not an issue of sympathy, it's an issue of solidarity and support for those people who have been denied everything. So, really, really very good point. One thing I would like to just to promote our activities in Palestine campaign in Sheffield, in line with what you said, you mentioned the word Al-Atatra, which is one of the areas which were badly hit by the attacks. And it just happens that our friends in Nusayrat, who distributed the money to the families, big part went to Al-Atatra area. So that's great that you are talking about Al-Atatra. And I thank everybody for their support. We said we did send money for 125 families during the massacres, and big part went to Al-Atatra because it was hardly hit. And the issue of cement you mentioned, again, we allocated some money from Shavit Palestine campaign to build a ball pool in a Nusayrat refugee camp, and the price nearly doubled. Because for one example, because there's no cement, as you mentioned, it's smuggled, and the cement price went from 40 shekels to 250 shekels for one bag. Mm-hmm. Can you believe? Nearly seven times the price, from 40 to 250. Unfortunately, there is like business people who are benefiting from this, and it's happening. So, but we did decide that we will send the money no matter what. If it costs us more, we cannot just hold it. And the ball pool will be when they will start building it. Because we cannot stop the situation in Gaza, will go on and on for a long time. The issue of prisoners, which you mentioned, is extremely important. And I know it's politically sensitive, but we definitely must start talking about support for the families. Maybe it's sensitive to support the cause of the political prisoners, but it's not sensitive to support those families who are abandoned and are really suffering. And it just breaks my heart all the time to see them having vigils outside the Red Cross and to no avail. So we really should talk about it and should try to link up. Thanks.
Just on the issue of cement as well, there again was a very systematic targeting of the economic and humanitarian infrastructure of Gaza. The statistics are really appalling when you read them. But one of the areas that was targeted was cement-making factories. Five were bombed. And at this stage, the government is actually talking about beginning a process of building traditional homes using mud bricks. And people sort of, you know, say quite ironically that with the fuel shortages and with the electricity cuts, etc., they're cooking with barbours again, which are these old traditional stoves that people's grandmothers would have used. Mm. But so they're using the barbour, and now they are being, you know, pushed back in the sense of rebuilding with what you know, their grandparents or forefathers would have built with. But this is something, you know, that I think really needs to be made very clear to organizations and solidarity groups, etc., that are fundraising in the West. internationally, that it is not just enough to fundraise. It is not enough to, I think, reduce the Palestinian struggle from a struggle for rights, for dignity, for freedom, down into a struggle for, as people in Gaza call, like a bag of flour. That this is not what they are requesting. They are requesting, of course, you know, the means and the assistance to keep people going, to be able to struggle. You need to feed one's children and yourself to be able to keep on going. But also, you know, that any humanitarian relief, any humanitarian initiatives need to be accompanied by political advocacy, by direct action, by, you know, the means for actually putting this within its context. So if people are talking about, you know, convoys, etc., it's very important, you know, and I think there's been a few very successful examples, such as the Viva Palestina convoy, but there needs to be understanding and awareness that tens of thousands of tons of this relief is backlogged in Arish because the Egyptian collusionist government will not allow it in. It is backlogged, obviously, at Israeli crossings, you know, as part of policies of collective punishment and slow starvation. And it's not just the starvation of food, you know, and people are not starving, but there is a huge increase in child malnutrition. And I mean, if you enter the family or the homes of families in many of the refugee camps, and also villages, which in some ways are less well off when they lose their land than people in refugee camps because they don't get food assistance. But that families that we work with, I've seen mothers, you know, feeding their children bread and chili as a meal because they have nothing else. But it's very important, you know, when we're talking about humanitarian relief, etc., always to emphasize the fact to anybody who's raising money or raising supplies that this has to be put in the context of rights-based discourse, and also that there has to be accompanying measures to get this relief in, because it's not at the moment. There is a convoy presently traveling to Gaza, initiated by the European Campaign to Break the Siege, and they're bringing ambulances, wheelchairs, crutches, etc., because these things are, again, on the list of the things banned by the Israeli occupation. But when we talk about a starvation, it's a starvation of hope as well. It's really medieval in its scale when you look at the lists of banned materials that are not allowed to come in.
Pasta.
Pasta, anesthetics, you know, water clarification pills, component parts for treatment, for sanitation, water and electricity plants, no building materials. For 3 weeks after the cessation of the bombing and the end of the massacres, although they have not really ended, or, you know, that's clear, but there was a banning on relief organizations being able to bring in mattresses and tents. And as a result, relief organizations were having to buy these at very inflated prices because they were smuggled in through the tunnels on local markets. And it meant, you know, that families were completely doing without. We were at a distribution center when there was a distribution of mattresses and blankets. And for every family, and some families would have 10, 11 children, there were two very thin mattresses and prison-style sort of blankets, four blankets distributed per family. These were displaced families whose entire you know, home and all of the possessions contained within it were completely destroyed or demolished. So there has to be a focus on that, but I think, again, you know, it's just really important with our discourse always to contextualize this. And I think, as was mentioned with the prisoner issue, it is a sensitive issue because of its direct relationship with the right of resistance, but I think it's something that's essential, you know, that we really pick up. It's essential that we challenge, you know, the criminalization of people who resist, you know, and that we legitimize, you know, the fact that both, you know, in terms of common logic and also international law, that an occupied people have a right to militarily resist that occupation. And I think, obviously, there's a lot of debates and differences in terms of the means that are used. But I think, you know, that until we as a solidarity community out here can provide a safety mechanism for those who choose to resist through civilian or non-violent means, then I think that the position of armchair analysts oftentimes, unfortunately, within the solidarity community of dictating to people how they should resist is a bit hypocritical. And until we can provide a mechanism that responds, you know, with the same level of sacrifice and dedication when people in Berlin or other communities put their lives and their bodies on the line trying to stop bulldozers and tanks, you know, then I think just the necessity of action, the urgency of it is so great. And there's so much potential, you know, and that was seen during the massacres. I think just this outpouring of outrage and grief and solidarity, but that really needs to be sustained and made into something that repeatedly, not just from one demonstration or one meeting to the next, but repeatedly breaks through that isolation, breaks that sense of collective abandonment, you know, and represents an alternative face to our governmental policies. And also lastly, I think support for activists, and I know this is controversial oftentimes within the anti-war or anti-occupation movement or scene, but support for activists who have taken direct actions in decommissioning or trying to demilitarize component parts, factories, etc., MOD sites, Edo, etc., Caterpillar, etc., but companies that are making profit off of the blood of Palestinian men, women, and children. And I think those activists are really heroic. They take great personal risk in doing so. There's some of the Edo activists from the Smash Edo campaign are facing years imprisonment, possibly. But hopefully, I think the jury of men and women who will judge their case will have some conscience. But this concept, I think, is something that is recognized in many religious traditions. I know in Christianity, the plowshares movement, the beating plow or the beating swords into plowshares, you know, the trident plowshare activists, etc. I think that type of movement really has to go on in targeting companies that provide the Israeli army with their tools of death and massacre. And I know certainly next year when the Edo activists go on trial, it would be great to have a solidarity movement around their actions as well. Because I think it's really the only position of conscience that you can take when you have these companies in your communities that are creating these weapons, but to decommission them, you know. And sometimes it's hard to do that because, the decisions that are sort of made in plush boardrooms and with pinstripes, etc., I think sometimes we give a certain legitimacy to that. It's so wrong, and it's a power, that needs challenging, and I think we need to break through the confines of the plush, boardrooms, etc., into reminding people what, no matter how divorced they are from the creation of that component part or the release mechanism or the F-16s or the white phosphorus or the cluster bombs, into the sort of images that us and everybody else who was present during those massacres witnessed. And sometimes, I just wish, that I could sit them down 5 minutes with sort of footage, which so many people witnessed during the massacres of desecrated lives, of broken bodies, of keening mothers, of just these beautiful, beautiful little children just desecrated, massacred, and see whether that conscience might arise in them. Perhaps not, but I think it's necessary, just to bring these images into them, to break through that complicity of silence and power, to try and reject the policies of profiting off of that.
Hi, I'd just like to say thank you for this really inspiring, great insight. You briefly mentioned like Hamas and Hezbollah. I was just wondering, as like, you spent a lot of time in that region, what is the general kind of consensus on the ground of the Palestinian people in regards to these organisations or these bodies that are existing in Palestine? And what exactly are these bodies doing in order to resist the occupation? Are they actively, doing anything on the ground with the Palestinian people?
Mm-hmm. Well, Hamas are Palestinian people, and Hezbollah obviously are Lebanese, but they have more progressive positions, certainly in terms of Palestinian civil rights within Lebanon. I think it will be very interesting to see after the parliamentary elections coming up early next month, where it's expected that the opposition and the resistance platform, which is Hezbollah and the Syrian Socialist Nationalist Party and the Aunis and Amal Party, but to see whether there is a translation from the discourse, which has been more progressive, not as brilliant as it could be, but on Palestinian civil, economic, social, and political rights within the camps in Lebanon, but whether that is translated into revising of the legislature that exists around Palestinian refugees in Lebanon into granting them some basic rights. But again, that remains to be seen. But it seems like there is a potential that the positions will be more progressive. In terms of Hamas, again, that's a very contentious issue. As I said, you know, I think that there in some that there has definitely been an increase of support for Hamas since the massacres among some communities. There's been a decrease perhaps in others. But again, in terms of a resistance platform, you know, that on a social level, Hamas are very present on the ground. You know, they obviously have more resources and facilities to be able to provide, in some ways, a relief for a support system, a welfare almost system within the vacuum that existed pre to them. They do run a lot of social programs, a lot of assistance for communities. But again, you know, as I stated, the hierarchical relationship is problematic. It's there on a military level. Hamas has actually, you know, ceased rockets launching for this period of time. There has been a lot of clampdown on other factions that are attempting to continue militarily resisting the occupation. You know, but there is, I think, within Palestine, definitely a discourse and an argument and a debate around the strategic sustainability of a rocket launching. Again, I think it's a debate that we focus much too much attention on in solidarity circles, because I really feel in some ways, you know, as the one and two state debate, that this ultimately will be for Palestinians to decide, that our role is in supporting, in accompanying, in solidarity with an oppressed people, but that ideological developments or debates within the Palestinian struggle and people is for the people of occupied Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza and in 48 and in the diaspora and exile community, which is the majority of Palestinians. It is for them to decide. But I think the role that we can be playing, certainly within those debates in terms of militarily strategic forms of resistance, and also in terms of the one and two state solution or political direction, our role that we can play to support that is continually, I think, bringing exile and diaspora Palestinians into our activism, in trying to provide them with channels, you know, whether they're first or second generation exile Palestinian activists, but to bring them into activities where they can challenge and channel and become voices within their communities. Because I think, unfortunately, you know, perhaps the state's excluded because there is a very active, very vibrant Palestinian second and third generation community of young men and women there who are so involved and articulate and organized. But unfortunately, there seems to be a lot of fragmentation in terms of just the lack of networking, the lack of sometimes confidence, you know, because of the immigration states of a lot of first-generation Palestinian immigrants or asylum seekers in Europe. But I think we can play a positive role in providing support, you know, and a space and a role for youth, for Palestinian youth living all over the world, whose voices are so important. I was at a Palestinians in Europe conference a few days ago in Italy, in Milano, and I had just come out of Gaza a few days before that, and it was so beautiful. You know, I just felt just so joyous seeing, you know, these beautiful families. You know, there was almost 10,000 people there, and, you know, Palestinians who, you know, we'd switch from sort of Arabic to English to other languages, and, you know, there'd be, you know, Palestinian, you know, young women who are all, you know, hip-hopped up and, you know, very funky and, you know, sort of speaking Swedish with each other and then switching to Arabic, and, like, their Arabic sort of being, like, falahi Arabic, like old, you know, what they would have perhaps learned from their grandmothers or from their parents. But seeing, you know, the potential of this community, the potential of these young people who have been raised in countries in Europe, who speak not only, you know, the semantic language, but also who have, you know, an understanding culturally of the context with which they're raised, you know, who know the arguments, who know the reality with which they're operating in terms of ignorance or awareness, and I think who would be incredible spokespeople for the Palestinian people in struggle, in terms of being that bridge for people who are trapped in Gaza, who cannot travel, who cannot come out, you know, who need a foreigner, you know, because of the racism of my passports and the rights that it gives me, you know, to be able to come in and be that bridge out. We really need to be encouraging them, you know, to take on that role as well.
So, following on from that, then, I really agree with what you were saying about, you know, we get caught up sometimes in meetings with these debates about the political reality of one state, two state, and for me that's not the role of sort of international solidarity organisations. But I wanted to ask you a bit more about what the views of Palestinians in Gaza has been about the role of internationals such as yourself going into Gaza, how they see initiatives like the Free Gaza Movement, like Viva Palestina and the International Solidarity Movement, and maybe a bit about the relationship between those forms of resistance and solidarity and the issue about the right for Palestinians to decide their own means of resistance, whether that be armed resistance or not.
I think in the context of Gaza, certainly in my experience, compared to the West Bank, because I lived in Jenin refugee camp for about a year, there tends to be, I think the foreigners or the activists who managed to make it to Gaza, just because it's a lot more difficult, you know, and wasn't really a reality for the last few years until the boats started going over, Mushir being on the first historic, I think, example of that. But the people who tend to come to Gaza tend to have previous experience, language skills, most of the time, cultural understanding and sensitivity and political awareness about the very complicated political scene in Gaza. We try and encourage people who have previous experience and language skills and cultural and political understanding, just because it's a much more intense context than the West Bank. I think there is definitely space and necessity for delegations and convoys to come to Gaza to view the situation, to interact with people, to break the isolation, and then to carry that message and that reality back to home communities, you know, to continue to motivate people. In terms of long-term volunteering or accompaniment on the ground, because of some of the problems that were occurring in the West Bank, in the sense of sometimes very well-motivated young people coming to the West Bank, but perhaps sometimes without a clear direction or focus about what they would work on, sometimes with a misunderstanding. But sometimes with a misunderstanding that Palestine could be liberated in a two-week holiday from university, and probably with an overinflated sense of their own protective mechanism for Palestinians, which I think is very disempowering. I don't agree with the concept of human shields in any way. I understand where it comes from, but this is not what we are, and I think we have to have a critical discourse in terms of racism and privilege, you know, and the fact that we use our white skin privilege to be able to stand in front of the tanks and stand in front of the bulldozers. But I don't think ultimately it's empowering for a Palestinian 40-year-old man to have some university or, you know, a high school kid come up and be able to talk them through that checkpoint in 15 minutes because they're blonde, you know, or, yeah, okay, so they get through the checkpoint. But what does that do? It's humiliating, really. So I think to have this balance between, you know, good motivations, dedication to the struggle, etc., but also a realistic awareness that we go there to learn, not to teach. And we don't go there to dictate to people how they should resist. And if we have practical skills, we can go there to share those skills, you know, in the context of workshops and work, etc. But there has to be, I think, a certain humility to it. And that certainly, I had lived and worked in Lebanon and South America before going to Palestine for a few years in refugee camps in Chiapas and Guatemala and South America. And I found that the sort of the activists who were involved in accompaniment work there seemed to have that a little bit more clear in their heads, that humility, you know, of going there to walk with the community, not to lead them, not to, and to learn from them. But so in the context of Gaza, I think that the response and reception of the different initiatives, because, you know, they have been, you know, I think quite inspirational, the Free Gaza boats, the Viva Palestina convoy, etc., are very well received in the moment of that. But I think in order for there to be trust, for there to be integration, for there to be mutual respect, that process of those who stay on or those who come for long time sort of periods, there has to be, I think, a very practical explanation, a very practical embodiment of why are we there. And certainly that's something that I found in between the first or the second and the third trips, the boats, when I was working as a co-coordinator with Eva Isavich there, that a lot of people would sort of come up to us and they'd be like, well, you know, the boats were a really good idea, but then, like, you know, how has this influenced, you know, their immediate reality? You know, what is it doing for them? How is it changing the situation? And those are very legitimate questions, you know, and people don't want to feel like they're in a zoo. They don't want to feel, you know, that it's delegation after delegation coming and feeling, you know, bad about their suffering and bringing something symbolic and then leaving. And people don't see, you know, and this is what we're trying to do, you know, while we're out here, is really document, take photos and, you know, video, etc., of talks, not necessarily where we're speaking, but where, you know, people are putting on these beautiful community, you know, very grassroots initiatives in support of the Palestinian people in struggle, and bring those back and show, you know, people this is what they are doing. When they go back, they talk to their communities, they talk to their workplaces, they lobby their politicians, you know, they go on demonstrations, they organize this, you know, that this experience touches people in such a deep way that it consumes you afterwards. Like, really, I feel probably a lot of you who have been to Palestine in this room, you know, it becomes your life. It consumes every waking and sleeping moment of your existence, and you have no other life. And some, I think, you know, sometimes we just accept this. And it's a good, you know, I think they're worth it. The Palestinian people and struggle are worth giving up our lives, you know, whether that's in terms of time or whether that's our lives, you know, in terms of putting our lives, you know, on the line in whatever form of work we choose to do there. But so there is, I think, a mixture of reception, but certainly after the cessation or of the bombing and, you know, the massacres, that there has been, I think, you know, curiosity and some hope generated by, you know, the talk of these convoys who are planning to come in, whether over land or by sea, etc. You know, and people do see them at least, you know, as some embodiment of an alternative reality, of a conscience, of a rejection of the policies of our governments. But I think if we're recommending people to go to Gaza, I always try and recommend, you know, that if it's somebody's first experience in Palestine, go to the West Bank, get some experience, have a deeper understanding, and then perhaps come to Gaza with a very focused, if it's not just a delegation for a few days, but if you want to stay for a few months or a few years, come with a specific skill, come with a practical project, come with connections already established outside in terms of twinnings, in terms of union support, etc. Because I think that way both, you know, the person who goes, the volunteer who goes, will benefit more from that time, and the community that they work in will benefit more practically from their presence as well.
I'm very grateful for the enormous integrity and commitment that you brought and explained so eloquently. There's one or two questions that are still in my mind that I don't feel are quite resolved by the ideas that you've expressed. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to put like this, it seems to me that in addition to all the things you said, it just seems to me one of the main tasks of the solidarity movements in this country and in the West, if you like, is to expose the responsibility of our governments for this crisis, the role that Britain in particular has played in creating the crisis, the role that Britain has played in actually in forcing Britain to take some responsibility in the Holocaust itself, the way they slammed the door in the face of the millions of Jews of Europe that wanted to find a place of refuge and that could not move in 1938. Mm-hmm. But also, particularly ever since, the way that Israel in so many ways has basically been a surrogate, a proxy for the West, has been carrying out the West's policy, the West has been totally hypocritical. Mm-hmm. And we have to unmask that, and not just unmask it, but also one of our main roles is to try and break the links between the West, military, economic, political, and the Israeli state, and it's only those links which make it possible for Israel to commit the crimes that it's doing. Mm-hmm. But it just seems to me that it's very much more difficult to do that if we have to have a neutral stance towards the two-state solution, because the two-state solution, so-called, is part of the Western conspiracy to defeat and divide the Palestinian movement. Mm-hmm. When the PLO Rit tore out the program, that first page of the Palestine National Charter that called for a democratic, secular, single state, they were doing so as a concession to the West, and they were trying to get a solution to their problem from then on under the auspices of the West and as an accommodation to imperialist designs on the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very difficult for us. We cannot ourselves, of course, solve the problem which has been created by that treachery And by that betrayal, we cannot do that. It's the Palestinians themselves that can and will solve it, that problem. But we cannot deny the enormous problems that it creates for us in terms of actually explaining what's going on and overcoming all the kinds of arguments that are used against us. Why it is that we're calling for sanctions against Israel and not against all kinds of other countries is because of the way Israel is a direct representative of the so-called democratic European imperialist powers in the Middle East. That's what makes it special.
I agree with you, but I don't think the position of perhaps humility in terms of this question is neutrality. I personally support the one-state solution. Ideologically, you know, I think it's the only logical solution, but I'm not going to either dictate to Palestinians or waste a lot of time engaged in semantic debates about what really, ultimately, we will have no control over. And I don't think we should have any control over it. This is an indigenous movement of people who have a right to decide their future and whatever Palestine, you know, as a dream, as a nation, will materialize itself into. But again, I think that involving the diaspora and exile community in this debate will ensure that the two-state solution will not be accepted. And there has to be a referendum. There has to be an international referendum of all Palestinians as to the direction, you know, the decisions that they take. And I think that there is a growing rejection, you know, definitely internationally of Palestinian diaspora and exile activists that I interact with, of their future being decided by representatives and you know, political leaders that they have had no say in electing, you know, which are illegitimate in their eyes. And there has to be, you know, that space for them. So I think it's important, obviously, always to have a critical discourse, a contextualized discourse, you know, of the hypocrisy, of the racism, of you know, of the political isolation, etc., of Hamas, of the hypocrisy and, you know, and double standards of the non-implementation of international law when it comes to Palestinians and Palestinian laws. But again, you know, I think that there are so many more pressing things that we should be doing with our time, in the sense of boycott and divestment and sanctions, in the sense of lobbying our politicians, of taking direct action against, you know, the companies that profit off the blood of Palestinians, of raising awareness, of educating people, of, you know, trying to fundraise, etc., for practical supplies that can go into Gaza without taking that out of the context of, you know, rights-based discourse, that I think sometimes there's just so much time. And I really, at this stage, after only 10 years within this sort of circuit, sometimes I just feel like when I hear debate after debate about things which really in the end, like, nobody, none of us will have anything in. But I think in terms of obviously educating and raising awareness of our communities, it's essential, as you mentioned, you know, that we not have neutral positions. I personally am for the right of resistance, for the right of military resistance, for the right of social and political resistance, for any form of resistance, you know, and I also personally feel that even if I wasn't, that I do not have a right to dictate to Palestinians how they should resist. But at the same time, you know, I think that our role should be clear, that we are supporters of this struggle. Unfortunately, we are not the strugglers. I would it would be an honor, I'm sure, for many people, you know, to join in that struggle. But and that we support in whatever way we can, you know, on the ground, from out here, etc. But I think that we also recognize, you know, our limits. And not that our limits in terms of taking risk or our limits in terms of dedication or sacrifice for this struggle, but also our position and what that is. And as I said, I think a lot of people who accompanied struggles in Latin and South America that I witnessed, I think they had that balance right, you know, that they were there, that they're thoroughly dedicated, that they're giving their lives for something that they believed in, but also, you know, that they were there to support an indigenous struggle of people, you know, who do not need us as their spokespeople. As a bridge, yes, but I think...
Hi, fantastic. Your passion is, and your articulation of your passion is, thank you. I want to know about the tunnels. Is Israel allowing certain tunnels to be open? And why?
There are many different opinions on this. I've heard, you know, opinions that that this was a new one actually that was thrown at me in another talk the other day, but that certain tunnel owners are engaging sometimes in rocket launching mm-hmm. to try and promote.
True.
Yes,
true.
And that I truly believe. But
sorry, I don't understand.
Well, somebody was telling me that certain tunnel owners, because it has become a total mafia,
yes.
and people are self-created millionaires at this stage from the tunnel business, but that people were saying that there are certain rocket launchings that are going on mm-hmm. Precisely to result in the closing of crossings so that people are relied on tunnels. And again, I'd say this is a minority, but it is. I mean, as I think anything that involves money, it corrupts people and you get mafia-type sort of structures emerging. Some of the tunnels, are run, I think, in a very pure, very honorable way in the sense that they're used, for specific goods, for specific supplies that are essential. But there are whatever. I mean, in any in any place in the world, you get people who benefit off of occupation and siege, etc. But again, they are the minority. The majority of the tunnels are used to bring in vital things that people both need and want. And I think that we should stop having this sort of focus just on it just has to be vital medicines. People also want supplies. That contribute to their lives in different ways. So the tunnels are used to smuggle motorbikes and bicycles and clothes and all sorts of goods and supplies. Animals for the zoo in Rafah were smuggled through the tunnels. Lions around Eid al-Adha. There were many goats and sheep and etc. smuggled through the tunnels. And the tunnels are Gaza's lifeline. When you have a people living in an open-air prison being collectively starved of supplies, of oxygen, of hope, etc., these tunnels are essential for keeping this lifeline open. I think of the tunnels as veins, actually, the veins that just pump these supplies into Gaza. But there have been many martyrs of the tunnels. They're called the tunnel martyrs. A lot of young men, young boys, because as the bombing of the tunnels has become more intense following the massacres and during the massacres, a lot of these tunnels, the bigger ones, they're sort of known as the more VIP tunnels in the sense that they're much more comfortable actually to walk through. Mm-hmm. You can sort of with a bit of ducking, but these tunnels are reduced now to tunnels that are much cheaper to build, rather than ones that are either tiled in or have electricity, etc. So these are tiny little tunnels where you need very skinny young boys to be able to crawl through, dragging goods with them or pulling goods with them. So there have been numerous. I mean, the statistics out at one stage, the PCHR was reporting 3 a week for a specific period of time in which they were heavily bombarding the tunnels because the Israelis use bunker busters on the tunnels. So even if you hit one tunnel, it causes cave-in sometimes for up to 10 tunnels in the area. So even if it's not a direct hit, it's very dangerous. But these are the veins. They are the lifeline. They are the oxygen flow and supply to Gaza. And I think it's again another example of Palestinian ingenuity when faced with such suffocating closures, that people continue, they sort of say they close the door in our face, we open a window, they close the window, we dig a tunnel, they bomb the tunnel, we, sort of dig 10 more, and they have to. If you look actually in the streets of Gaza, whenever there were fuel shortages, the fact that people were using alternative forms of energy, the increase in solar panels when they could actually get them into Gaza, sort of propping up everywhere, people running their cars on chip or on vegetable oil, converted engines. The fact that if you go to any shop that repairs any electrical device, and I'm a complete techno dunce, but literally, I mean, you just see them doing things with nothing and repairing things and making do. This is a thing. People just make do on less and less and less. The rates of unemployment have soared again. They were very high before the war, before the massacres, but after, even higher. The fact that over 80% of Gazans are receiving one form of food assistance or another from the different organizations that distribute. And this is a very proud, highly educated populace of people. The Palestinian community, both in occupied Palestine and in the diaspora, have one of the highest levels of education, of doctorate degrees, of third level education of any community. So you see a very proud, very noble, very very strong and resilient community, you know, really reduced down to being dependent. And that is humiliating for people. It is thoroughly humiliating. And I think that's something, you know, really that is not understood by donor and relief organizations, that there's a way of distributing that actually, you know, preserves some of the dignity of those who receive this distribution, and that the people are not accustomed, you know, to standing in lines and waiting, you know, for handouts. And I think there is a lot more success in, you know, and I think, you know, obviously I'm sure Sister Muna, who you probably know, in organizations such as hers and many others, Palestinian organizations who I think have a really positive impact on international donor organizations and relief organizations, in the sense of educating them about how to do it in a way that is culturally sensitive, that is sensitive to people's dignity, you know, and that does not humiliate people, which is delivering to people's homes, you know, doing it in a way in which people, that their needs and their desperation and their poverty is not marked on them like a stamp for everybody to see. But again, you know, I think that is part of the strategy of this occupation and siege, keeping people donor dependent and increasingly more donor dependent. And that has a very debilitating effect, I think, within society in general as well. And a lot of programs that are being conducted or carried out by international organizations are not sustainable. They're not about vocational training or, you know, bringing in the supplies for creating, you know, community-based initiatives or revolving loans or things that actually can be sustained and can empower communities. They're very much focused on, you know, daily or weekly or when UNRWA has to stop its deliveries because they're not getting any supplies in, you know, up to monthly or every few months, but distributions. And that's something I think that if we are talking about fundraising, as well as, and I think it's brilliant that the solidarity donations were given to families, because that is also essential when you have families who are in desperate need and they are not receiving. And it's not just supplies that they need, but it's having the luxury of choice. If your child is sick, that you can go out and buy that medicine instead of having to wait in a UNRWA crew or a queue, you know, for hours to be able to get a prescription that you might not be able to fill, even if it's discounted. You know, if you're cold because it's still winter, you know, that you can actually buy a real blanket instead of using these prison, you know, thin things that fall apart, you know, on any washing, that were distributed by a lot of the organizations. That you can buy clothes and shoes for your children because they fled in terror during the night, during the bombings. So solidarity donations to specific families, I think, is something that is, it's good because it's a direct form of solidarity too. And if articulated within the discourse of this is solidarity from one brother to a brother, from a sister to a sister, from a comrade to a comrade, you know, it takes that charity element, or, you know, that sort of discourse out of it. But also funding long-term sustainable projects and camps is essential, and there's a real need for it, and there's a real thirst for it. People want to be able to earn the living. They don't want to be dependent. And in any way that can be supported, you know, such as some of the women that I met with earlier were talking about, scholarships, you know, for young women students. It's brilliant. And other such initiatives. There's a lot of scope. And that's actually something, if you guys want to take my email, and I'll give you email of other folks within Free Gaza, and obviously Mushir and Hills in Sheffield can help facilitate this, I'm sure. But we can keep in contact about identifying specific projects, if you want to fundraise, that could be fundraised for. One of them that we're working at the moment in some of the camps that displaced are community bread ovens for women, so that they're not dependent on this bread distribution of bread that people don't really want to eat anyways, because it's processed bread, it's white, you know, factory-made bread, instead of, you know, traditional homemade bread. Community kitchens, so that people have the right to be able to decide what they want to cook for their children and cook it, instead of waiting for these hot meals that have been distributed. Temporary community centres to act as, and this is just because there are no building supplies. It costs about maybe 2,100 and something pounds, but it's basically a steel infrastructure and then this sort of white canvas. It's like a big sort of circus marquee. And then what we've been doing, we've provided two of these, is buying 150 chairs and big wooden tables so they can be used for first aid training, for workshops for women, for psychosocial activities for children, etc. And these are in the camps of the displaced, just to be able to have a space where people feel that the community can actually come together, sit together, have meetings, decide, you know, what they want to ask these relief organizations for, instead of relief organizations telling them what they need. And this is the last thing, but before, just a few days before we left, we had a meeting in one of the camps of the displaced near our Tatra in Duan, called Al-Samud Camp, or Al-Az Camp, sorry. But we had this meeting, and we called all of the women from the community and their children to come and sit with us in this tent, and we talked about what they needed, what they thought, if we could raise money on these speaking tours, what we should, you know, give it towards. And we had a really interesting interaction, and it took hours, and people were arguing, and all of the frustrations of living together in this camp, the displaced, and, you know, sort of, quarrels came out and people were getting very angry because it was a space, it was a forum in which women could actually vent a little bit at each other in a very polite way. But by the end of this meeting, we actually had, you know, a list of things that they felt that their communities needed. And after the meeting, we had all these women coming up to us saying, this is the first time anybody has asked us what we want instead of, you know, telling us what we need. And that is such an indication, I think, of the downfalls of relief organizations. So there isn't this interaction, there isn't this respect, this consultation. So if you guys want to support any projects, there's plenty that we could give. And that might be a practical thing to involve a broader community of people who don't have time, who don't want to be active perhaps in demonstrations, but who want to do something practical. Mm. And on that note, because I feel I'm talking too much, but funny.
Well, thanks very much for coming to the thing. It's absolutely inspiring. It's about 200% of what you just said, so that's possible. And I think in particular the comment you made about passing human rights to self-determination and, you know, taking their lead and, you know, supporting them in their struggle, because it is their struggle, is just something that you do need to remind people of a lot in the UK, because obviously people have their own sort of pet theories and stuff, and trying to impose their own solutions and stuff, and I think that's 100% correct. And I think it's really positive that you're doing a speaker tour and that you're getting around Europe as well, so
yeah,
it's been this important message. And I think obviously, like, the crucial thing that we have had to be doing in the last sort of period of time is sort of just relaying the facts of what's happening in Palestine, and reminding people that Palestine has been occupied. I think a few years ago there was a survey commissioned in Britain of students in UK universities. I think overwhelming majority of students thought that Palestine was occupying Israel, which is obviously ridiculous. But I hopefully now the events, particularly this year, have challenged those illusions. And I think sort of the facts of the situation is beginning to surface, and a lot more. We're starting to take things to a new level, I think, in terms of solidarity in this country. And I know that there has been a shift in people's consciousness in this country, and a shift in the media, even though it's horrific still, and there's only so much you can kind of gloss over and so many facts that you can hide. I just wanted to know what internationally, and not just in terms of Western Europe, but, you know, broadly, what kind of shift, I know you've only just come out of Gaza recently, but if you've had a chance to sort of catch up, which I'm sure you really have, what sort of shift have you seen, and what opportunities and constraints are there for an international solidarity movement? Where do you think the sort of struggle is in terms of solidarity in the West and, you know, in the Middle East as well?
I think in the West, certainly, and this is something actually that was widely reported within Gaza, the student occupations that went on, and I was speaking with some students earlier about the occupation here, and really hats off to all students, you know, who just took that step in terms of the occupations, which I think were really moving, you know, the discourse, you know, into an environment which is really necessary as well in terms of politicizing, you know, the next generation of students. There was a lot of reporting of a lot of the demonstrations of the boycott movement, you know, the positions taken by Scotland, Ireland, and recently South Africa, in terms of official union endorsement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. There's awareness of that in Gaza. There's also awareness, obviously, of the positions taken by the Venezuelan government, by Chavez, by Evo Morales, the position certainly of, you know, certain governments within the Arab world, and the very shameful positions or non-positions of the majority of Arab governments. Unfortunately, Egypt being probably top of that list. maybe next to the Saudis and Jordanians, but no, I think Egypt probably wins hands down because they've got the border. And I think that is something, you know, that we should really be pressing as a solidarity movement as well, a travel boycott of Egypt, and make it really clear why we're requesting that. You know, and I don't think it will antagonize, you know, the situation at Rabat any more so than it already is in terms of people entering, certainly in terms of convoys, etc. But I think it's a very important message to relay, because it's essential, obviously, that our focus is on Israeli war crimes, but they had secondary partners in some of those war crimes. And if the border had been open, obviously most Gazans, I'm sure, would have stayed out of steadfastness, out of etc. But there was no safe place to run to. Those who wanted to escape, those who wanted to keep their children safe, were trapped, and there was no place to flee to. You know, a mosque, a church, a hospital, etc. were not safe. So the opening of that border is essential. But I think in terms of a solidarity movement, you know, it's uniting these different strains, these different activities. Like, we've really found this around the prisoner issue. There's a lot going on, but it's all very isolated. I mean, if you actually Google, you know, activities around Palestinian prisoners, you come up with sort of conferences in Canada and, you know, activities, you know, in all these different places. But there's no broad campaign, you know, that or coalition. It doesn't have to be there can be autonomy within in it. But I think a similar thing has to be done in terms of bringing this out beyond, you know, first of all, beyond Britain, linking with solidarity organizations all over Europe that are doing really inspirational things, such as the French, comrades, inviting them over here maybe to, or you know, recruiting folks here who would be willing to do that as well. But there's, I think, potential within Europe, but also there's so much going on in Latin and South America. Making those links in Africa and Asia. I mean, a few years ago, after I came out of Iraq, I did a speaking tour across India and Pakistan, and it was so interesting. I mean, just like some of the talks that I spoke at, you know, were hundreds, and demonstrations, you know, not specifically about Palestine, but I was invited to speak, you know, hundreds of thousands. And then I'd go, like, be taken up to these tiny little villages where there'd be, you know, just a handful of families, but they'd be so politicized and so aware. And I think it's just putting that time into actually making those links, you know, and getting a broad focus, you know, in terms of what our direction should be, in terms of BDS, in terms of, you know, direct action, in terms of actually building a Palestinian political lobby, which diaspora and exile Palestinians could play a vital role in as well. You know, and it needs to be done, that work of just steadily constructing, you know, just injections, inlets into, you know, political, media, legal, you know, civil society spheres, but in a much more serious way. Because I think the problem is we only respond to Palestinian moments of crisis. But Palestine is in continual crisis, and we really need to remain focused that, you know, when the ante is up and it's up to emergency thing, okay, it's great that we have demonstrations, but that needs to be sustained.
We've got 10 minutes left.
So do I have time to...
Last question, but if Eva wants to show her film,
yes,
then we can have the last...
Yeah, it's just on... I have two questions, but I'm going to skip them because I don't want to comment on what you said. Although I agree with you 100% on the need to openly criticize and expose the Egyptian regime, I don't think we should take it in any way or shape into action against Egypt itself, because we enjoy tremendous support among the Egyptian people.
Yes.
And Egyptian people are extremely emotional. I lived in Egypt for a long time. I could say it's my second home. And they tend to change positions easily, and if they see their country targeted, now the propaganda against Hezbollah in Egypt. The big sections of the Egyptian people are turned against Hezbollah. There are still support for Hezbollah, but big sections have followed the mainstream media. So I don't think we should target Egypt in any direct action or any boycott campaign. Definitely, we should condemn the regime openly. No reservation, but it's a sensitive issue, and we don't want really people to focus on the issue of Israel, because Egypt is doing a terrible thing, but it's doing it because it's saying to the world, I have a peace deal with a peace agreement called Camp David with Israel, and I don't want this peace deal to be jeopardized, and I don't want to be under attack or whatever. I'm doing it for the prosperity of my people, obviously falsely, but that's what they're saying. So that's my point. I just wanted to pass.
Point taken, but I think they're also, you know, and this should be explicit, but doing it because they're the second biggest beneficiary of American USAID and aid. And I mean, I think in some ways, because this is a debate actually that we have frequently, you know, as activists, you know, the defocusing in any way attention, obviously, of Israeli war crimes is not in anybody's interests. But I do think in terms of a travel boycott, that if it's articulated very clearly, you know, that we are doing this in solidarity, not only with the Palestinian people, but the Egyptian people, we're doing this in solidarity with you, because we know that you support the struggle, because we know that in your hearts, you know, you're there in Gaza, and yet when you try and organize a demonstration in solidarity with the Palestinian people, you are repressed. You know, you're political prisoners, those in prison who are being tortured, etc. You know, the mass arrests of thousands of activists from Kifaya and the Muslim Brotherhood, etc., during the attacks on Gaza. So I just wonder, in the sense that the reason, you know, that I would promote this, in the sense that I don't think that we should defocus attention on the Israelis, is only really because I met with a number of Egyptian officials during, you know, some of them from the opposition, some of them who are sympathetic but who would not class themselves as opposition, which actually makes them in some ways a more valuable ally because they're not so under attack or under siege by their own government. But all of them unanimously said that the only reason that the groups of doctors who got into Gaza from the Union of Arab Doctors and other groups, the Norwegians, etc., during the war, was because a lot of the demonstrations by solidarity groups out here were going, first of all, to the Israeli embassy and then having secondary smaller things outside Egyptian embassies. And that put the Egyptian government in such a defensive position that they're really trying to clean up their PR image in terms of letting those delegations of people in, or those delegations of doctors in. So I just wonder, I think if it's done cleverly, if it's done in a way that makes it very clear that we stand in solidarity with the Egyptian people, that we honour, you know, their commitment to the Palestinian struggle, etc., I think it's something, you know, that might be able to move, at least if the demands are clear, you know, that Rafah, for instance, be open one day a week for medical patients and students and separated families to be able to leave or enter, you know, that the process is reviewed because it is so bureaucratic and so corrupt. You know, without perhaps using that term, because that will definitely put them under defensive, despite the fact that it's a total mafia at the border. But I just wonder, you know, if it's not done, you know, I'm not talking about direct action in the sense of smashing up Egyptian embassies, more in the sense of basically saying, you know, that we are not prepared in conscience to spend our money, or our families or friends to spend money on tourism in Egypt while this border inhumanely remains closed. So, I mean, maybe it's something that could be debated or discussed, you know, and certainly, I think Moshe's obviously insights into this are very valuable. But I think it's also sometimes worth thinking, you know, that there is this whole argument of, oh, you can't alienate, you cannot annoy the Egyptians, you cannot, you know, our brothers are, but they're not, you know, the government is deeply complicit in the oppression of the Palestinian people. And if there can be a stance taken in a very professional, very clear, you know, very calm, very logical language, you know, until, you know, this is a boycott that we'd be endorsing. It might, you know, it might help to shift something. Maybe not. Anyways, I want to thank you all for your time, because I realize this has gone on for a very long time, and I've only just got a glimpse of activism in Sheffield over the course of today, but it's really brilliant, and I think that just hearing about the different activities and stuff, really, hats off to you as well, and mashallah, like all and everything else. But again, I'll leave my email here, and if people want to follow up practical things around linkages between paramedics, etc., or also schools, universities, hospitals, then it's definitely something we can keep in touch about. Thank you. Unless we're